A couple of years ago, Jennifer and I were looking to downsize a little bit. And one of the things that we determined was probably a good thing to do, that we had plenty of, were books. Still do have a lot of books. I don't think I managed to downsize quite as much as I thought I did. But there were some books that I had picked up years ago when I studied in England, and they were the Saint books. You remember The Saint, the old TV show with Roger Moore? He was sort of like a secret agent kind of guy. His name was Simon Templar, and since his initials were ST, his secret agent identity was The Saint. Well, I didn't know this, but they were based on books, and when I was in England for a year to study, I didn't have any of my personal belongings. That was all in America, at my folks' house. So I picked up at a used book sale a bunch of Saint books. And I brought them home from England. I shipped them home because I hadn't read all of them. And they were sitting in a box for many years. And when we decided to downsize, I thought, now's the time for me to get rid of them. Since they're English books, they must be kind of rare in America. I could probably get rid of them and probably turn a little bit of a profit for them. Well, two things happened. One is when I checked out on eBay, which is where you can go and sell things that you don't need anymore. When I checked out on eBay, they're not nearly as rare as I thought, going for about, maybe if I was lucky, 45 cents a book, which even with 10 books is not going to get me very far, is it? And the other thing that really tore at me a little bit was, even though I don't know if I'll ever read them again, they are from a time in my life that I know I can never go back to. They're valuable because they're from a time when I was in England and I had this particular group of friends, and we're never going to get back together again. That exact combination of people will never happen again. It just won't. And I know that. And it sort of makes me a little bit nostalgic about these books. So I've kept them. I don't know if I will ever read them again and open them up, but I can't part with them because they mean something more than what I could actually get for them in money. So they are, for better or worse, mine, and downsizing has gone by the wayside. But the question that this brought to my mind is, what is something worth? It's the same question, and I want to ask you this Sunday. We're always talking about what things are worth. You can, like I said, go on the internet and you can find out what something is worth. I saw this amazing device the other day at a used book sale that you can buy, and you can plug it into your cell phone and it scans the barcode of your book, and you can find out what it's selling for on the internet. So you can tell whether you're going to be paying a fair price for it or not. It's a rather remarkable little device. I don't know if they'll allow you to use it at some place like Walmart or something like that. They probably don't like that. But it is something that can be used. But we're always asking and talking about what things are worth. What is good health worth to you? Or what is being debt-free worth to you? Well, this morning's lesson from Isaiah is about what is the vision of the holy mountain of God worth. What is the image of the holy mountain of the Lord worth to you? Now remember, Jerusalem was on a mountaintop, is on a mountaintop. That's why it's often called Mount Zion. It was perched on a mountaintop with valleys on either side in what is today Israel. And God says in chapter 65 of Isaiah that he will remake and refashion that mountain, that city, so that it will be a joy and a delight. Unlike any city on the planet in the year 2010, there shall be no more weeping. There shall be no more cries of distress. Even nature shall be radically transformed by God on the holy mountain. the enemies, the natural enemies of the wolf and the lamb, are going to feed together next to one another. The lion eating straw like the ox, and the serpent eating dust. There shall be no hurting or destroying on God's holy mountain. Now, if I asked you what that was worth, we would say that vision is priceless. It's a holy vision. It's a holy vision that has no imaginable price tag. But what I take away from Isaiah 65 is this, that Isaiah 65 is not a human possibility. You and I can't transform nature to the way that a lamb and a wolf could lie down together and be friends instead of enemies. You and I could not eradicate from the world weeping and crying and distress and death. Only God can do this. It is beyond human resources to make this holy mountain of God, to make a heaven on earth. Sin is too strong. Human limitation is too great. Isaiah 65 is something that is in God's control, not mine, not yours. It is clear that this vision of the holy mountain of God is priceless because it is A, so rare, and B, so unattainable by your hands and mine. So that leads me to the next question. What is the worth of living in a world where we can't reach that mountain? What happens next? What are we called to do as Christians in this moment? We can't bring about the vision, so should we just give up? Should we just say, well, God will do it in God's time? I would say no. What we have to do is we are called to be God's people who practice Christian virtues to keep this vision in the forefront of people's imaginations. Sort of like we were talking about with the kids in the children's lesson. Somebody has to preach that message. Somebody has to make the car run. For example, throughout the Bible, especially in the New Testament, Christians are called to patience. We are called then to help people see that God will act, maybe not today. We're called not to get impatient or to fanatically try and make this holy mountain happen. Throughout human history, people have tried to do that. People have tried to separate themselves out of the world and tried to make God's vision actually happen, tried to make God's vision real, tried to force God's hand, creating a commune or a sect, keeping all others out. But it's never worked. Nor are we to go in the opposite direction, growing cynical that God hasn't acted yet and getting bitter, wondering why the vision of Isaiah 65 has yet to appear. To non-Christians, the virtue of patience will seem like an eerie and odd virtue. Get up, do something, be active, find something to do. Yet to Christians, what we're to do until Isaiah 65 comes to fruition is to make disciples of Jesus Christ, is to make more of us who are patient and peacemakers and loving and forgiving. We're to teach all those things in this space. And to many non-Christians, the church will seem like a strange place where we're out of touch with the real world, where we don't talk about realities on Sunday mornings. Isaiah 65 is pie in the sky hopes to non-Christians, pie in the sky hopes about tomorrow or the next day or 10 years from now. But we live in a real world of budgets and potluck dinners and heated debates about replacing the carpet in the social hall. But it is that very same church, warts and all, budgets and all, debates and flaws and everything, that is given the task by God to tell the story of Jesus Christ again and again and again. And to be patient, never flagging, never giving up hope, never turning away. I'll give you an example of how this works. Take a group of people, say us. We all have our own opinions and our own politics. We all have our own fears. Only you know what worries you woke up with this morning and have been carrying around for the last couple of hours. Or only you know what tears you went to bed with last night. Yet when you come to this place, to this church, you all, each and every one of us, become part of Jesus' story. We sing, not alone, but with the angels. When we were baptized down into the water just as Jesus, as companions with Jesus in the Jordan River. When you come to this place, you come not to hear an opinion of the preacher, you come to partake in God's very life. You come to hear inspirational words from the Bible that will turn you towards the virtues of charity, hospitality, justice, and forgiveness. And we turn to those virtues because they're deeply imprinted on God's heart. Therefore, they must be on yours as well, because you belong to Him. That's why this place is worth something to us. To go back to that original question, what is this place worth? It's worth a lot because it's a place we need to support. Not because the light bill needs paid, as important as that is, or that we need to buy office supplies, but because we want to support the witness to Jesus. We want to see that continue. We want to carve out a holy space in this world where life is affirmed, where people are loved, where forgiveness is practiced. This space means life, living, holiness. This is where we encounter the Lord. Or perhaps there's another example. Maybe you've heard of the short story written by Elizabeth Ballard called Three Letters from Teddy. It's a fictional story, but it illustrates the point, I think, pretty well. It's a story about Miss Thompson and a student in her fifth grade class whose name was Teddy. And teachers are not supposed to have favorites in their class, but most especially teachers aren't supposed to dislike any child. But we all know that in reality, sometimes we don't hit it off with people. And Miss Thompson disliked Teddy. She didn't hit it off with him. He was always dirty. His clothes smelled musty and unkempt. His hair hung down over his ears. And by the end of his first week at school, he was way behind the others at class. And when Miss Thompson tried to get him to participate, he did not. He would not do much more than answer no or yes, and would never elaborate. He had no intellectual curiosity. Miss Thompson took an immediate dislike to him, and she took a particular joy in marking Teddy down. She'd X out in red pen his wrong answers, and she enjoyed with flair remarking on his poor homework that he turned in. And as the Christmas holidays approached, Miss Thompson had pretty much written Teddy off. He was further and further behind everyone else. He would definitely repeat the fifth grade. Miss Thompson, because she was a teacher, was allowed and did it for every child, looked into his school record and saw that some things changed throughout the years. In first grade, his teacher had written that Teddy showed promise in his work and attitude, but he had a poor home life. In second grade, the next teacher had written Teddy could do better, yet his mother is terminally ill, so he receives little help at home. In third grade, it was written that Teddy was a pleasant boy, helpful but too distracted. He was a slow learner, and sadly his mother had passed away at the end of the year. And in fourth grade, Teddy was very slow at picking things up, but was well behaved. But his father showed no interest. Well, Miss Thompson thought to herself, they had passed him four times, but he will certainly repeat the fifth grade in my class. This will do him good to show him how the real world works. And then the last day before Christmas arrived, and the class had a little tree set up on a reading table, and teachers get presents. If you have any teachers in your family, you know what that's like. There were all sorts of presents under the tree, and right in the middle was a present that was obviously from Teddy, wrapped in brown paper and wrapped with masking tape. And he had colored it in himself, pictures of Christmas trees drawn with crayon and pictures of stars. "For Miss Thompson," the package read, from Teddy. She opened it up and out fell a cheap rhinestone bracelet with most of the stones missing. And there was a small bottle of drugstore perfume, the cheapest kind, that was already half empty. The kids started to giggle a little bit because Teddy just didn't fit in, and the kids realized this was an embarrassing gift to give your teacher. Yet Miss Thompson stopped for a moment and said, "Isn't this lovely?" She placed the bracelet on her wrist and looked at it and said, "Oh, Teddy, would you help me fasten it?" And she put some of the perfume behind her ears and gave some to the other girls. And the kids, taking the hint, played along for a while. And the party went on, and she opened more presents. And at the end of the day, when all the other children left, Teddy came to Miss Thompson's desk, and he said to her, "You know, you smell just like my mom used to smell. I really like that, because that's her perfume. And her bracelet looks really pretty on you. I'm glad you liked it and are wearing it." And awkwardly, he shuffled off. He left quickly. Miss Thompson put her head down at her desk, crying, asking God to forgive her for her judgmentalism. After the Christmas break, the children came back to class, and it was a new Miss Thompson. She cared in ways that she had not before, and she especially cared for Teddy. Everyone in the class got a fair shake, and Teddy eventually passed fifth grade because of the work that Miss Thompson put in, and he was ahead of many of the other children. Miss Thompson and Teddy lost contact, yet 7 years later, an envelope arrived with no return address. "Dear Miss Thompson," it said, "I just wanted you to be the first to know I will be graduating second in my class next month. Very truly yours, Teddy." 4 years later, Miss Thompson receives a second letter. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know I was just informed that I'll be graduating first in my class. University has not been easy, but I liked it. Very truly yours, Teddy." And 15 years later, a third letter. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. As of today, I am Theodore J. Stallard, MD. How about that? I'm going to be married July 27th, to be exact. I wanted to ask if you would come and sit where my mom would sit if she were here. I'll have no family at the wedding because Dad died last year. Very truly yours, Teddy." Miss Thompson went. She went to the wedding and sat where Teddy's mother would have sat, because she deserved to be there. She was patient. She did something great for the kingdom of God while waiting for the Lord to create wholeness out of death, to transform Jerusalem into a holy mountain, to transform hatred into love, to transform death into life. It is the job of God's church, this place where we stand, to craft more people like Miss Thompson. And that is my hope, so we do, for that is why the church is here. Amen.